I forgot. He just eats, sleeps, and jerks off here. I'll keep my big mouth shut.
You're listening to the Still Queer as Folk podcast. Each week, we take down an episode of Showtime's Queer as Folk TV show to find out if it still holds up 17 years later. I'm Patrick Randall.
And I'm Matt Dominguez.
This episode is called Solution, How TLFKAM Got Her Name Back. And that stands for How the Lesbian Formerly Known as Melanie Got Her Name Back.
It first aired in the U.S. on April 15th, 2001, and worldwide on April 30th, 2001.
It was directed by Michael DiCarlo. He directed episode 11 called Surprise and episode 14 called A Change of Heart. He eventually directed a total of 11 Queer as Folk episodes. He also directed an episode of the 2008 show Kyle XY. I remember hearing about this, but I never watched it. So I looked up the description of the show, and I just wanted to read this for you, Matt, because I thought that you would find this amazing. The central character is a teenage boy who awakens naked in a forest outside of Seattle, Washington, with no more knowledge or abilities than a newborn and no belly button. Future podcast?
Maybe. You do know that the guy that played Kyle XY is gay.
I did not know that.
And married, and I think has a child now.
I wonder if there's any other XY, Kyle XY podcasts out there.
It's probably Kyle KY. Anyway.
Ooh.
Nailed it.
Your grandmother's lube again.
This episode was written by Jonathan Tollins, who wrote 6 Queer as Folk episodes. His work was most recently seen from when Fox aired their live production of A Christmas Story, the musical, which had Matthew Broderick as Ralphie and Maya Rudolph as the mother, which I loved.
Was Matthew Broderick was obviously older Ralphie, right?
Yes, he was the narrator, as it were.
Yeah, I didn't see that. I'm going to have to try to pull that out, take a look at it. The Showtime synopsis for this episode is Dr. David and Michael host a high society fundraiser. Michael excludes the gang. Lindsay and Guillaume prepare for the big day. Justin continues to be harassed at school.
While we talk about the high society party that he hosts for a senator, I'm going to make sure my pinky remains up the entire time.
That was a great scene. I look forward to talking about that in a few minutes. There was a couple themes in this episode that I picked up on. And the thing I wrote down in my notes is the more things change, the more they stay the same after all. So we see Michael going into a fresh direction in his life, but in the end, he's still fundamentally the same person. And by the end of the episode, he's completely headed back to his original self. Same thing kind of was going on with Melanie and Lindsay, where they tried to be apart, but that change started to be a little too much for them. So they came back to who they originally were. We see lots of change, and then we see that things are really the same after all. And that was really the only theme that I was picking up out of this. How about you?
No, I agree. And I think it's a great way to show from the beginning of this episode where we have Michael in the most mundane detail describing that wonderful Paris trip that he and Dr. David Cameron went on from the previous episode. Everyone is over and not really paying much attention as Michael continues to put on this...
It was a slideshow.
Oh, God.
That really dated it right there.
Well, yeah, and you hear the click, click, which is really funny because my uncle, who's an art professor, I've been through these slideshows out of all of his trips in Europe. But what's amazing about it is the way, like, whenever he's describing a certain landmark in Paris, like the Arc de Triomphe, he like is overemphasizing the phrase and the accent. It always bugged me because I saw this all the time in college. Anytime someone went abroad and came back, they literally changed the way they spelled words. So many people I know went to London and they came back spelling everything the British way. And I'm like, are you going to tell me that you're 6 weeks away from the U.S. has completely changed the way you've written things?
Same thing happened to Madonna.
Oh, and that bullshit.
She came back with the accent. No.
And no one was buying it.
I did like in this scene how Brian and Justin were making out on the sofa.
Yeah, it was French.
Yeah, we're Frenching.
It's French. We're Frenching.
Because Brian's usually only about fucking. It's like this romantic thing is something that we don't see him do too often.
Yeah, they were real couple-y.
Yeah, it was cute to see them all cuddled up with Justin and making out versus, like, Hotlanta.
Now you can either stand around here eating jambalaya, you can come upstairs and eat my ass.
I like that scene. I don't know why it was there, but maybe 4 episodes ago, we started to see that Brian's relationship with Justin has evolved to the point of where he misses him when he's not there and he likes spending time with him. He stopped making fun of him every time he shows up and he just likes being around him. So we're seeing that character evolve quite a bit as we race towards the end of series one.
Well, we're seeing their recognition that this is a relationship, you know, a relationship that has many open corridors, but they have found a central person to connect to. And it's, I mean, it's very clear in this scene because they're obviously not paying much attention to the slideshow.
Yeah. Did you notice in the slideshow that we never actually see the slides until the end? There's only one picture of them in Paris that we see.
Yes. And I was okay with that because that trip sounded boring as hell.
Oh, I thought it sounded great. But it was just such a terrible visual at the end of Michael and Dr. David in front of L'Arc de Triomphe because it was so clearly fake.
And Dr. David Kerman didn't look thrilled in the photo.
Yeah.
He was just kind of like straight face, not even really smizing.
It reminded me of that stock footage when Justin ran away to New York. And we see that stock footage of New York City, like dating from the 70s showing up. This photo kind of reminded me of that. One thing I saw in this scene too is Emmett and Ted were cuddling. They were kind of like all wrapped up with each other. I thought that was kind of neat also.
Yeah, it was sweet. It was also, I love that Ted was like snoring.
Yeah. I did like Debbie's line where she says,
"Tastes like cum. Where's the cheddar?"
I have had brie on multiple occasions, and I disagree with that assessment.
Debbie is definitely a cheddar girl.
Yeah, I think she would be more happy with, you know, like a cheese whiz kind of thing.
The scene kind of dumbed down everybody in the gang except Ted to make the point that Michael has now gone global. Everybody was sort of portrayed to have never left Pittsburgh. And we know that Debbie and Vic have. They went to Italy together for Vic to die. So
I don't think they were dumbed down. I think they were just bored. I mean, it's a slideshow of a trip that was being very dryly explained to them. I mean,
well, Michael also had that line about how these guys have no idea that there's a world outside of Liberty Avenue.
Which I'm glad David then made a point of like, well, neither did you until like a week ago. And yeah. I was like, thank you. Don't act all high and mighty, Michael. Yeah.
Why wasn't Guillaume there? He's French. He would have enjoyed the slideshow.
Oh, I think he would have been annoyed.
Yeah, he...
It's like listening to this American with a terrible accent explain his culture.
I think that it would have been great, though, to have him there as the comedic barb throughout everything.
Well, so. I think it would have... Well, I think there that would have already heightened the tension that was already existing in the scene between Mel and Lindsay.
Yeah.
Because it was very clear that tension was still there. I mean, props to them for being in the same room like that. You could tell that they're like, they want, like, Lindsay wanted some sort of distance from Mel, even as Gus is trying to be like the middle ground for them.
Guillaume was all of a sudden being deported in this storyline, but he apparently had been with Lindsay at the university teaching for years and years and years. So I'm wondering why he's all of a sudden just being deported.
What
new president?
Didn't they say something in the first time we met Guillaume that there was, like, his visa was expiring, and so, but like, then why didn't he just renew it?
Yeah, if he's an academic here? And he's teaching there, that shouldn't have been a problem. I think we're getting too technical about poor Guillaume. He gets what's coming to him.
Spoiler alert for what comes later.
Did you see when everybody's loading up into Ted's convertible that Mel just opens the door and just says, shotgun? It was this tiny little moment. And I really wonder if it was improv. It was really great. I like those little lines that sneak into the episode.
Now it's too late. It's all my fault. And there's not a goddamn thing we can do about it. Shotgun.
This scene kind of set the stage for an upcoming Senator Baxter party at the Architecturally Perfect Mid-Century Modern House. We had to get all the characters into Dr. David's house and see Michael in this mode before we could actually have that next scene.
Yes, they've mounted themselves as quite the power couple.
Yeah.
So to now say that they're hosting a fundraiser for a senator, and I'm glad that there was a point made where Dr. David Cameron says, oh, I don't mind if you invite them. Invite them if you want. You know, the open invitation is there for Michael to invite all of his friends and his mother and his uncle. And Michael, Emilia, sort of thinking he's doing everyone a favor by not including them.
Yeah, I thought there was a little bit of weak writing going on with that. It seemed like there was something missing from that storyline. We'll talk more about that as we progress through the episode. Meanwhile, Justin has to go to school. So we see yet another scene of Justin and Daphne arriving at school together. I don't know how many times we've seen them walking up those fucking steps into the school, like debriefing each other.
It is the standard intro for bringing Daphne into the story.
Yeah, those are expensive shots, too. Those are exteriors, and then they transition to an interior. So they're spending money on these throwaway shots just to work Daphne in into the story. So they step into the schoolhouse, and Justin's locker is on fire.
And what did it say? It said fags die.
Yeah.
Or die fags, like spray paint on there. And when he went to touch the locker, it was like literally still hot. I don't know if they set it on fire or if they set off some sort of like M80 or something.
How does this happen in a school? I mean, these days, the whole school would go into lockdown. All the children would be like up against the wall and searched. And all we hear are people taunting Justin in the background with an assortment of fag lines.
I mean, this episode was what? It's post-Columbine, but pre it's every post other 9/11, major shoot. Though. And it's also, no, this is.
That's pre-9/11,
it's
I guess.
It's pre-9/11, yeah.
Yeah.
So a lot of the safety measures that we know of today, especially in a school that is okay with certain behaviors towards certain students, as we saw in previous episodes.
But you can literally start a fire in the school and nobody's like giving a second look. They're just waiting for Justin to come in and burn himself. How do you not notice that? And, you know, pull the fire alarm or something like that and say, hey, fire alarm, we get the day off.
Pranks can be elaborate in high school. Like, it's amazing how creative some crazy students get.
When I was in high school, I used to be taunted that way, and people would mess with my locker, but they never set it on fire. They just
remember these are also high school kids with money.
True.
So they probably have means in which to do such things.
They have access to explosives. So all of a sudden, we're taking a stroll up the Rue de Liberté. That will be Liberty Avenue.
Liberty Avenue.
With Brian, Emmett, and Ted, they come across a gold Miata.
Why were they excited about a gold Miata?
I don't know. I wrote that one down. I wrote, a gold Miata. What the fuck? And it's the middle of winter and they have the top down.
Not now, nor have I ever thought a Miata was a cool car, let alone a tacky gold one.
Michael comes out of the, I guess it's the dry cleaner.
The dry cleaner, yeah.
Where he's picking up his cleaning. And
Dr. David.
Dr. David's cleaning. He's pretty oblivious to his friends thinking that he's at all different. He seems to be acting completely normally. You know, he didn't have any errors about him. He was just snobby there.
Well, because he makes a comment about that. He's like, weren't you the ones that told me to enjoy the fact that he's a giving person, that Dr. David Cameron's a giving person, you know? But I'm glad that they also were like, wait a minute, he bought you a car? And he's like, yeah, isn't this what you said I should do? And it's like, well, okay, I understand if he's like, he might buy you dinner, he might pay for the cab. Buying a whole car for you outright
and having it gold plated.
With Captain Astro. Actually, I thought the Captain Astro thing was sweet, but still, it's a car.
Yeah, I've never bought anybody a car.
You're not that kind of sugar daddy, Patrick?
No, definitely not. I do like this new Michael, though.
Of course you would.
Well, the character had been, as we've talked about in previous episodes, a total buffoon. We believe that he had never left Pittsburgh. He'd never been to the country. He had never left Liberty Avenue, and I like seeing a new dimension into the character. He's got this confidence around him that I found interesting. I did like how they're going to dinner with Bobo and Melisande.
Like on first name basis, as if the other guys are going to know who these two people are or what this restaurant is.
Is it Bobo that does Dr. David and Michael's finances?
Yes.
Or was it Melisande?
No. Bobo, I think, he handles their investments. That's what it was.
Yeah. I thought Ted was the investment banker of the... Well,
what I find interesting is Michael's choice of the word our.
Yep.
Everything, it's like everything is now shared between the two of them. And I think I definitely read a sense of jealousy in our other boys.
Yeah, he had our sports club and our investments. This scene was pretty interesting, and I did like how it was putting Michael into this different air entirely, and he was dressed differently and acting differently, and I just like that dimension to the character.
Did he get a ticket?
He did.
And he kind of just like brushed it off like it was nothing.
Right, right. Nice little prop work there. Yeah. So let's stop by the Franco lesbian house. So, I say that because Guillaume lives there now, and Lindsay's trying on her wedding dress, and Guillaume comes into the bedroom where he mysteriously finds Brian. It's like he didn't know that Brian was there. And I like that kind of little petty bickering between Guillaume and Brian that always goes on. And Guillaume's trying to keep Gus away from Brian.
Oh, I call that sexual tension. I think Guillaume and Brian are like ready to like pound that out.
That would have been a really interesting
later
arc
on
there.
Like later on, I literally thought that was going to happen. We'll get to it. We'll get to that moment.
But, oh, I wish it did. Now that I think about
right?
it.
But it's very clear that Brian is no longer on board with any of this. He's no longer, he even says this is a farce, yeah. Which I thought was a very interesting way to describe it.
I did like that Lindsay seems to have this sense of permanence that Melanie is gone for good. Almost as if she's already moved on from Melanie, which is interesting because that was quick. She pretty quickly kind of finalized this and is going to have her sham marriage to Guillaume. And
that's that. Yeah.
Yeah. So the story was a little thin there, but I kind of liked it because without that moment, we would never have this tension a little further downstream in the episode with Lindsay. And this also gave Brian the opportunity to become the rematch maker of the whole thing.
he's Dolly Levi.
There was a line in there about Vermont. In 2001, Vermont was the only U.S. state that allowed same-sex civil union. So I like that that got slipped in the episode and memorialized forever in the show. So back at Debbie's house, Justin's telling the story of the arson to Debbie, Vic, and Jennifer.
The return of Jennifer.
Sherry Miller, welcome back.
Lost my mind when I saw that Jennifer was back. I was like, what does it take to get her in? Just an arson. Attempted arson on Justin. Thank God.
She delivers the goods in the scene as Jennifer Taylor once again. The one thing that I kept remembering about this scene is, why aren't the police involved? You can't be antagonizing and assaulting somebody this way without getting the police involved. And Vic is like Mr. Doom and Gloom in there about Justin has to know the truth.
Vic is coming from, he's thinking he's a realist. But what I want to make a big point of is this being a private Catholic school, and it is the gay kid being picked on.
That was me. I went to private Catholic school.
I'm so sorry. I went to public school.
I wore a tie and a blazer every day.
I did not.
Cheers.
The key to this, though, is that, of course, the police didn't get involved because the administration would undoubtedly describe it as boys will be boys, or like that's just a part of high school life. That's why it takes Miss Jennifer Taylor to show up to make anything happen.
Well, she in the scene, we didn't immediately know what side she was on. Debbie is kind of having a go at her.
And you stand beside him.
Debbie, would you please stay out of this?
I forgot. He just eats, sleeps, and jerks off here. I'll keep my big mouth shut.
And you know what? And Jennifer recognizes that because I think she's
backed off.
Yeah, she's very I think she's very appreciative that Debbie has taken Justin in this way. And I'm glad that Justin felt comfortable. I would like to think that it was Justin that reached out to his mother.
So that evening at Dr. David and Michael's architecturally perfect mid-century modern house, Brian shows up. It looked like it had just blizzard in Pittsburgh. There's like 2 feet of snow out in the yard. And there's Michael in the garage wearing his leather jacket and a turtleneck sweater.
Was that the Hugo Boss that was purchased in the previous episode?
Probably. Brian had some good lines here where he's taking Michael to task over what the new Michael Novotny is.
The trip and the clothes and the car, they're boring. You're boring.
Boring.
Oh, I happen to think I've become a very interesting person.
You've become a fucking little snot.
One thing I noticed about this scene is that Michael and Brian were dressed almost identically. So
yes.
Michael almost seemed to be trying to emulate Brian visually.
It calls back to that episode where Michael first had his first date with Dr. David Cameron, and they were trying to dress him up, and Brian dresses Michael up basically like him.
Mm-hmm.
And then we see what Michael's behavior is like afterwards, where he, you know, goes to the back room of Babylon and has this random hookup. So yeah, it's interesting to see them look so similar now.
Yeah, and Brian had this great line.
Why? Because I finally have a life?
Whose life?
Yours?
Or his?
And that got me thinking, is Michael knowingly becoming Dr. David's marionette? Does he realize that he's becoming like incredibly different to what his friends have known him to be for years?
I don't think he's consciously doing it because, I mean, we've seen how he has to rely on the advice of all of his friends for mm-hmm. every little thing. So as he's trying to negotiate, like, how much do I allow Dr. David Cameron to purchase things for me? Because remember, originally he was like, no, it bothered him so much. And then they said, yeah. No, you should just relax into it. And allow
now he's
him.
All in.
And now it's like, now is it too much? And so he's trying to find this balance. The trouble is that it seems it's his friends who are telling him when he's too hot and too cold, and he's going back and forth and back and forth. And I think that's building the conflict in him.
It was a good scene. It was really short, but it was very, very good. And I like how Brian just sort of rolls up there in the Jeep. They got the Jeep in the background and everything.
The Jeep is back.
Yeah. The next morning,
Jennifer has come to the principal's office, and I would fear that for that principal if Jennifer Taylor walked into my office.
She was great.
She was not having it.
Justin tells me that over the past couple of months, he's been physically attacked, harassed, called names, and nothing's been done to stop it.
It's like, why aren't the police involved? He's being attacked.
Again, boys will be boys is going to be what happens here. Because, like, you know, she shows up and says, so this is what Justin is telling me is happening at school. And he's like, oh, well, if I had known, I would have obviously stopped it. I was like, bullshit, you knew.
Right.
You knew and you didn't do anything about it because you're going to hide behind the religion of the school. Not having it.
At what point as a parent would you let this continue? I mean, why wouldn't you pull your kid out of school at that point and put the kid someplace else if he's being attacked and trying to set him on fire and things like that? You don't leave the kid in that dangerous situation for too long, do you?
As we saw in the previous scene when Jennifer was at Debbie's, is that she tried to say, well, she asked the question, can you back off a little or not be so apparent or something like that? And he's like, no, it's not about that. It's not about me.
This is about speaking out, demanding to be heard whether people want to hear you or not.
Where'd you learn all that?
It's what you and Dad taught me.
My dad?
Well, he sure as hell didn't learn it at the St. James Academy.
Yeah, that principal is just coming up with excuse after excuse, and Jennifer is just knocking every single one out, and it's great.
Being a veteran of private high school, I can attest that it's private property. They want to do whatever the fuck they want to do, and the parents really don't have a whole lot of say in it, which I think these days parents would lawyer up right away. They would.
Well, aren't the parents the one paying the tuition? Wouldn't they have a say? Wouldn't the schools want to make sure that they're not losing their money?
God has a higher say in everything. This was a good point to note that this is where Jennifer Taylor becomes activist mom. She is clearly on Justin's side from this moment on. She never wavers again. And we're foreshadowing a little bit because obviously we've seen the show. But this was the moment. This is where everything for Jennifer became all about Justin and protecting him.
Right. Suppose I gave you permission to organize your club, and then another student came to me and asked to start a club for, say, white supremacists. Should I allow that too?
Excuse me, Dr. Perkins, but I happen to find that analogy extremely offensive.
Some of our parents would be hard-pressed to see the distinction.
Well, I'm hard-pressed to see the similarity.
Not everyone is as accepting of your son's sexual preference as you are.
It's not a preference.
Oh, I went, whoa, where did we make that jump? It's the same crap argument that's saying that by having two people of the same sex getting married, next thing you know, they're going to want to marry an animal. And I'm like, the people who think that are the ones that are really messed up.
great writing. Our hats off to Sherry Miller for playing Jennifer Taylor here. Just so,
so pitch glad perfect. She's back.
Well, let's stop by the diner real quick because Vic shows up there. Every now and again, they roll Vic out of Debbie's house, and I guess he's well enough to to leave the living room and put on some real clothes. And he shows up with the newspaper that's announcing the Senator Baxter soiree, we'll call it.
In the society pages? I guess that's...
Yeah, the society page of the gay rag. And Michael shows up in his Brian outfit, I guess we'll call it. And he's mortified to find out that everybody else saw the ad and they know what's going on. There's this really great play between Ted and Vic when Brian talks about making a donation to the party and they're kind of looking at each other. Ted's like, yeah, this is going to be good. And Vic's like, oh boy, this could get bad.
But Vic was secretly enjoying it too.
Yeah, he came around. He probably saw it as an opportunity to get out of the house again and go right. to a party.
Because everyone at this table is assuming that they were invited because they're Michael's friends. And Michael eventually has a blow up saying that they're not invited and it's yeah. not their thing and they can't show up. And he's screaming at Debbie, which...
Yeah.
That just broke my heart.
Oh, poor Debbie. She puts up with so much.
She does. That's where Brian gets the idea about upping his campaign donations.
Oh, of course, he has to consult with Ted.
Right, because that's, yes. Oh, man. Is this when we get to the party itself?
Yes. Party time at the architecturally perfect mid-century modern house.
It looks like the safest gay party I've ever seen.
I like this scene. This was hilarious.
This was sort of a highlight for me as well.
Yeah, I remember over the weekend when we were watching the episode separate from each other, and you had sent me a text message about this scene as soon as Emmett walked in as Jackie Onassis. Oh,
yeah. So let's get to the setup before our friends arrive.
Okay.
So it's Michael and Dr. David Cameron. Everyone is in like neutrals and beiges, and it's obviously these are the power gays, not too flamboyant, not too showy.
The A-gays.
They're talking with Senator Baxter, and you know, I love the fact that it's a woman mm-hmm. who's running. She seems to actually like genuinely care, and the decorations are gorgeous. You know, they're sort of like this winter feel. Everything just looks architecturally perfect.
They even had like those little twinkly fairy lights in there.
Yes, right.
On the imaginary trees and waiters. Hot waiters too.
Ooh. Ooh. And
well, and, <now.
laughs> and like everything, it looks like everything is just right. Everything is just perfect. And then you feel like you could hear the record scratch as the group arrives and they are like,
it was like the Village People showed up.
Oh, I was obsessed. You got Ted in leather. You have Emmett in drag as Jackie Onassis. On point, Jackie Onassis. I was very here for it. And Justin is in a crop top.
Typical twink wear.
I love that Vic is pulling out like the full Charles Nelson Reilly look. I was here for everybody's looks. They were there to serve. But there was this one moment.
What was Brian's outfit? I didn't quite get his. He was like 70s swinger or something.
Yeah, it was, you know, flashy. I don't think it was polyester. It had to be silk. It was polyester, would have smacked the hell out of him.
I didn't understand his outfit.
No. But there was this one moment where Ted and Emmett shared a look at the exact same time. And I'm like, I want a gif of that moment. Because they hit this like pose at the exact same time after a comment. And it was brilliant.
I'll see if I can make one for the episode when we post it.
Because I want to use it in every conversation. But, you know, they're there not to be malicious. They're there to like say, well, Michael, go fuck yourself. Also, we can handle these people too. And it's pretty fabulous where this party goes.
I thought it was a little bit of an evil thing to do to Michael, though. Even if we say he deserved it, this is really getting kind of vindictive. It was
again, he sort of had it coming.
But still, it's like these are his friends.
Well, and it was such an interesting line that they were balancing. I mean, for Michael, they crossed it very clearly. But as soon as they see the check that Brian cut for the senator, Dr. David Cameron, he's like, They can do whatever they want. I don't care.
This is the one and only time I think that we see Dr. David being political. There was a tiny little script mistake here. Dr. David says to Michael, and look at you now, drinking champagne with a senator, but Michael clearly had a martini in his hand.
I don't know if that was a mistake. I think that was just him.
He's hammered.
Sure. Let's just go with that. It's a tiny little detail that I wasn't necessarily bothered by. But we know that Justin has decided to change it from the smooth jazz. That
jazz was fusion.
Jazz fusion.
This music sucks dick.
I believe it's jazz fusion.
Yeah, in physics, a fusion is supposed to cause a blast. Like this.
Yeah, one flick of the stereo and all of a sudden it's Babylon.
And we see how everyone else has dispersed at the party. Debbie has cornered the senator and Ted is hitting on this guy.
I'm not into leather.
Hey, you know, neither was I. And I ran into this old school friend who shackled me in his dungeon and made me his suck pig.
That was my second favorite part of the gang's antics there. The first one I liked was Justin in his little crop top taking on that really square-looking guy. He grabs him by the tie and drags him away, and the guy's like, whoa, this little twink's after me.
Right? And
Ryan and the hunky waiter might have been...
He was literally just like, he literally shoves a martini down his throat.
That waiter was hot.
Oh my... And he looked like Brian. I don't think that was a coincidence. I do love that Emmett like found a group of guys. And he's like, oh no, you are wearing the wrong clothes to show off your bubble butt. Everyone off. Like that whole sequence was amazing.
I just kept coming back to David just rolling with all this and letting Michael be batshit crazy about
it. Well, he was trying to like reel him in, but it was an interesting display for Michael and I guess him trying to be like not like them.
Yeah, I just thought that Dr. David should have been a little more upset over the gate crashers at his party. Instead, he was just like, okay, whatever.
Yeah, it was...
Maybe it's the money, like you were talking about that one.
I think it was the money. I think he saw that the party was going well and that the senator was happy. And it's like, hey.
It was really going well because when they pop out of like the kitchen or wherever one conversation is happening, everybody out there is in various states of undress and they're all dancing. Everybody's having a great time at this party. And I want to go to that party.
Well, and even
I'll support Senator Baxter.
And even this, and even Senator Baxter says, like, usually when I come to these things, they're boring and dry. And this is just a hoot.
Yeah.
And I'm like, oh, maybe she really does love the gays. Good for her. Like, it's so very obvious that it could have just been a political ploy for her to show how progressive I am. But no, she was like, she relaxed and she became best friends with Debbie. And she's just like saying, this is just wonderful.
The best part was this. I think this is where you're going with it, was this slapstick physical moment with Emmett and the shrimp cocktail.
Oh, my God.
And so to describe it, the waiter comes around the corner. He has a tray with one shrimp cocktail on it, complete with the tartar sauce. He stumbles. It all lands on Jackie O / Emmett. And so she's covered in shrimp cocktail. And Ted comes around the corner, grabs a shrimp, reaches around and scrapes the tartar sauce off of Jackie O / Emmett. And eats it. Loved that. It was just so well staged.
Oh my God.
And still, even with such antics, you know, Brian had just led the waiter up the stairs and is disrobing him. He's probably going to bang him at the top of the stairs.
Oh, not
Michael
even probably. He did.
Still upset. Even though the entire party is just digging it, even after Emmett ends up with the shrimp cocktail all over him, the party's still going on, but Michael's just crazy.
It's hard to crack this dramatic shift. And I don't know if it's because he could pick up on, like, this was obviously a ploy for his friends to get back at him for not inviting him. And so he sees it as petty and that they're ruining everything. Even though everyone else, including the senator and David, are not, like, he's literally the only one bothered by it.
Yeah, I kind of sympathize with him, though, and I think he's got a point, because if that happened to me and my friends kind of crashed a party that way that I had been careful to stage manage, I think I'd be pretty pissed off about it. I'd have a hard time just rolling with it the way that Dr. David and everybody else was. I just think that his friends behaved badly. Michael reacted in kind, but in the end, everybody else was having such a great time. So maybe that's the point of where you just say, oh, okay, this was not what I wanted, but it's going so well. Let's just leave it at that and have a good time. I'll take my jacket off. I'll loosen my tie and I'll see what I can do with it.
Well, also, watching the scene again, I think the reason why maybe Dr. David Cameron was so lax about everything is he was sort of, you know, putting back those martinis.
So he was.
But it's really great to see that, like, Debbie and Senator Baxter found this common ground that, you know, she was also a waitress who did it to, you know, help her family and support them. And so they find this common ground in being powerful, independent women who care so much. And it was just really fun to watch that. And then it just made me even angrier at Michael for being such a little prick.
There's this spinning shot around Michael. Then it reverses to his view of all of his friends. It had this sort of now what have I done feeling to it because he's pissed off. We see that in the first shot, the first spin around him. Mm-hmm. Then the spin kind of does a figure eight and is looking at everybody else. And we see through his eyes how his friends are kind of looking back at him. So this was probably the moment where we know that Michael realized that they did it on purpose. Maybe they shouldn't have done it, but he's pissed.
How dare you do this to me? And to David.
You what? I was just talking to Diane. Do you know that she worked as a waitress to take care of her family?
She was just being polite.
Polite?
Do you actually think she wanted to spend her entire evening talking to you?
Well, it's not as if I nailed her to the floor.
I think you should all leave.
You know, he really only makes him have his ass hang out because he did this in front of everybody, including the senator. So it's like, who really made you look bad, Michael? You kind of did it to yourself. Brian conveniently runs into Guillaume at the grocery store.
This scene I liked.
This is what I'm talking about, where I literally thought, like, somehow Gus was going to get dropped on the floor and they were going to fuck.
Oh, my God. I think Brian's learned his lesson about putting his needs ahead of Gus's.
Yes.
The thing I liked is that on Brian's lunch break, he goes to the local grocery and buys a bag of grapes for his lunch. I like that. And I like that visual gag where Guillaume is picking up the aubergine. Or the eggplant, as it may be called here. I thought that was funny where Brian says something like, is this for you?
That's not a coincidence. I think that was a big hint towards Brian going like, you see this? This could be you.
I think this scene, I think this episode really could have been better if we knew that they fucked.
it would have carried the episode for you.
It would have. I would have been okay with the interstitial lesbian scene there. Speaking of scenes that kind of annoy me, the next one on the steps of the school where we generally only see Daphne and Justin entering the school, Justin is leading a gay protest. It had my least favorite protest chant, that hey, hey, ho, ho, something, something has got to go. I hate that chant.
Homophobia's got to go.
I hate that hey, hey, ho, ho protester chant. We got to come up with something better. It's just a little too
much
Seven Dwarves.
It worked, though.
Well, it was a setup because it was really just to get the senator there.
It was fantastic, though, because Debbie knows that she has that in her back pocket as the principal comes out.
We're protesting St. James Academy's bigoted policy on student clubs.
Taylor, I have had just about enough of this.
It's called freedom of assembly, pal.
This is private property, and you're all trespassing. I'm calling the police.
You might want to stick around for this.
Oh, and the smugness on Debbie's face. Priceless.
The one thing that was funny is Senator Baxter was introduced as a state senator. So how many people recognize their state senators? You might represent, or you might recognize your senator, but for the state house?
Well, I think
that was a little weird.
Well, no, the key to this, though, is that she showed up with a camera crew.
And a bunch of aides. And if Justin knew that the camera crew was going to come, he shouldn't have worn that big shiny parka that he had on.
He's a kid in Pittsburgh.
Like, but just one or two episodes ago, he had this beautiful top coat on with a nice fur collar. It was gorgeous. It looked like something that Brian would have worn. And now they put him into this big poofy silver thing. This scene was just weird.
I liked it. And I loved that it showed that the relationship between the senator and Debbie continued to carry through. It showed that it wasn't just some bullshit thing that came through from the party, that it carried on because they found their common ground and that it was put to a good cause.
So at Brian's loft, I guess that night, Justin's in bed. Brian's wandering around with his Jim Beam. Fortunately, this time he was drinking it out of a glass, not straight out of the bottle, as we've complained about in the past. It's still Jim Beam. Something I noticed in this scene where Justin's kind of wandering around. He wakes up and Brian's not in bed, so he's trying to find him. That entire scene was shot handheld, not Steadicam, handheld. I don't know why, though.
I think it comes down to, like, there was a period where I felt like to show grit, you shot handheld. You know what I mean? It was like to show that we're going to be intense and up close. We got to make sure this is handheld.
The only thing that I could think of here was that it was trying to obviously show that Brian was drunk. So it had put the viewer into kind of this bouncy little disorienting type of thing. It was strange. I thought it was a strange choice for the director to make there. There's some interesting dialogue between Justin and Brian, and Justin had this line.
Brian, I'm the most mature person you know.
And I'm like, really?
How? Justin thinks highly of himself.
But Brian didn't really combat that line at all.
I mean, I will say Justin has...
He's almost like a Brian whisperer, you know?
Yeah, and he's called the group out on their bullshit numerous times. Maybe he has some agency to describe himself as that.
But don't you think that Brian knows other mature people like...
No.
Melanie, the lawyer? Ted, the accountant?
Well, we know that Melanie has also, you know, acted irrationally too.
Like, well, so is Justin. I just thought this line was very unusual to have there. It really was questionable whether it's true, and you're left wondering why Justin would say it. In this scene, Justin did act very maturely, and he had good lines. It was just all of a sudden like, Justin's mature. You know, he went from being that teenager to the know-it-all. We've seen over many episodes him building up to this, like when he's teaching Michael how to behave at table, for example. This was just kind of out of the blue, I thought, and that line didn't really track with me. Well,
but we've also seen how his character, how he has grown since first coming into the series.
True.
He has had to do a lot of growing up very quickly.
There were two lines that I thought imbibed Justin with a higher sense of self than we had seen before. The first one was when he said,
I think Gus is going to speak French before he speaks English.
That line was designed to get Brian's attention and to kind of snap him out of it. That's pretty wise for Justin to be saying that. And the second line was to Brian.
Being mean to me has never really worked. You should try another tactic.
That showed an awful lot of self-awareness there.
Yeah, he knows, because I mean, the proof is in the pudding is that he's in Brian's bed right now.
Yeah.
Like... You know, this
the one
is
night
how
stand
you,
that never went away.
Exactly. And Brian is not necessarily cutting anything off.
The scene was supposedly about Brian and Gus, and Brian kind of wrestling with the notion of Gus coming under the influence of Guillaume. But the B story there was really Brian and Justin. I thought that came through a lot better than seeing Brian and Gus and Guillaume together.
We now cut to the Franco lesbian home.
The next morning.
And Guillaume is... He is on a schedule, which part of me wonders, like, did he know that Brian was going to try and do something or like what? Like, yeah, there was just something like the frantic nature of Guillaume in this moment was very strange in a way.
Yeah, ostensibly it was to get the marriage license, but it probably would have worked better if it was like their immigration appointment or something like that, something that you can't miss. If you miss the marriage license appointment, so what? You go back like later in the afternoon or something like that. You miss an immigration appointment, they'll come pick you up. So his franticness.
Well, maybe that's tied to his franticness, is that he probably couldn't afford to wait on the marriage license either.
Yeah, maybe that was his last day.
So that's why they were, you know, trying to get it done.
So well, then Brian
we know from earlier in the episode that the deportation letters have come through, and that's why they pushed up the wedding. That's probably what's going on.
Brian drags Melanie over.
And who has no idea why she's there.
Yeah, a claim of an accident with Lindsay or something like that.
Look, we're in a hurry.
Yeah, I swear, I had no idea he was bringing me over here.
We have to leave.
He said you had an accident.
An accident?
That was the only way.
Brian is mysteriously brokering the relationship, the rematching of them. Or what is it that Gwyneth Paltrow calls it? Consciously decoupling? So she's consciously, Brian's consciously coupling the two lesbians back together. I like that that happened because heretofore we're always led to believe that Brian is just trying to break them up. And I like that here he is bringing them together for the sake of Gus and to get Guillaume the fuck out of there.
And I think it's also like, he's like, even though I have all of my problems with Melanie, he knows that they are the ones that are right for each other. You know? And it's nice that he can recognize that.
And he still seems to have a sense of responsibility to Gus. You know, he wants what's best for his kid, even though he's not always up to doing something about it. Lindsay had this great line.
Do you still love me?
I never stopped.
I think that Lindsay had talked herself into thinking that Melanie didn't love her. She just needed to hear it from her to have it reinforced. Because remember, Melanie was the one that left. You know, she took off.
Yeah, they had the notion that one instance of cheating meant that it was over. There was nothing that they could provide to one another anymore. You know, that was the basis for her cheating. And so she's like, well, since I did that action, I shouldn't be here. We should end this thing. I mean, the way they keep apologizing to each other, which I love that Brian's just like, the first thing I don't want to hear is this. And what do? They immediately are like, well, but it's true. You know, I did it. And I'm like, oh my God, if this is how they've been behaving lately, then yeah, they belong with each other.
Brian comes out of this scene looking pretty good. He got parental rights waived on Gus for the lesbians to have joint custody of him. And that's a pretty big deal. Once you waive those rights, you don't get them back. So
yeah. And so it was like, that's a big step. And everyone is so happy and like, they're going to get back together.
The wedding's off.
And then we look over at Guillaume.
Say au revoir, Gus.
Poor Guillaume.
He literally says, and what about me? And Lindsay at this point, like, sort of felt bad.
Yeah.
She's like, oh.
Okay.
So, and she's just like, sorry. And he just gets up and leaves. And I'm assuming he has.
We never see him again. Never.
Got deported.
His name is never mentioned again. Never comes up again.
The end for Guillaume.
The UK version that had this storyline was much different. In that story arc, Nathan had some incriminating evidence, which led to Lance, who is the Guillaume character, attacking a home office immigration officer. And the whole thing was orchestrated by Stuart.
Oh, that's more malicious. Because there was nothing bad about Guillaume. He just sort of was stuck in the middle of a messy situation.
The UK version was much more edgy. The US version was a little more sappy.
It was less melodramatic, Patrick.
Yeah.
I think it's a little over the top to say there is a whole orchestrated event to get the Lance character to attack someone. Like, I mean, that's a stupid
thing. I don't think
they
got him to attack him. I think they just wanted him arrested, and Lance just kind of went batshit crazy. Took a swing
at him. I would too
if
I knew that there was a conspiracy to get me arrested and kicked out of a country.
Well, that's what you get for fake marriages to lesbians.
You're awful.
That's true. This isn't Green Card. This isn't Gerard Depardieu.
He also is not the only guilty part. You know what? We're not talking about the UK version anymore. You've already, you know what? That's going to count you two chips for that.
Because I mentioned Gerard Depardieu?
You made me mad, Patrick. We're going to move on.
I make you mad every episode. I just got to stop. Let's go to Debbie's house and have some Italian food in the living room on TV trays with Senator Baxter. There was a nice little line here from Senator Baxter about Bush. the line went strung together.
Nice little
Bush.
Topical moment.
Yeah, but watching it now, it's sort of like, oh, the good old days of President Bush. It's like, that wasn't so bad, was it?
Well, no, it was still pretty bad, but I mean, at least we could somewhat contain it.
Yeah. This scene was a little improbable, but I do like these homey little moments in the show where there's some love and there's some family and everybody's gathered together. They're sharing something like meal or drinks or something like that. One thing I picked up in this episode is that Justin is like so annoyed and put out every time Debbie asks him to do something, like, get the senator some pasta or get a glass for Michael. Justin is living in her house. It's like the least he can do is get up and do what she asks.
Well, I think, like, I mean, he's
being so petulant.
No, we see him cooking a lot. Like, he's cooking breakfast and everything. I
think. Did you see the looks that he was giving Debbie in the scene? Every time she said something, he was just, I didn't like that. I thought that was out of place there, especially because this gathering was really, as a result of his protest at the school. They protested and then they went to Debbie's house to have dinner.
And to celebrate what they did.
And then Michael appears.
Looking guilty as hell, as well he should. No one should ever talk to their mother like that.
And then he makes up with Debbie, but I don't think he ever apologized, did he?
I don't think the words actually escaped his mouth.
Yeah, they were just kind of looking at each other, and it looked like Michael was about to tear up, and Debbie gives him the lecture, and then it's like, all's forgiven.
She did the motherly thing. She knows what he's about to say, and she's like, let's just...
Oh, hell, let him say it. This is a drama show. We need to hear it.
She got what she needed as a mother.
Brian and Justin apparently had enough, so they go out back, and Brian is smoking a joint. And what was that little move that he did with his joint with Justin where he takes
he was shotgunning him.
What is that?
It's where you pass off the smoke without them. Well, no, great. He got a little fancy with it. Usually it's someone takes an inhale and then like blows it into your mouth.
Yeah, but he took the joint and spun it around and put it in backwards. And then
again, I thought it was like that. I was like, that's some fancy work there to shotgun someone, but that's what he's essentially doing. But like the whole, let's get to the point of their conversation. It's funny that
I only know the hard drugs and you know the slow drugs.
But like, let's look at the point of their conversation outside is that, you know, Brian doesn't want him to get too comfortable. Like, yeah, sure, the senator did this time, but that was to make her look good, which I don't necessarily know if that's true.
Well, what are those lines there for? Why does he need to say that to Justin? We never see the senator again.
I mean,
do we?
It's sort of the point that we see lately that we can't be complacent. It's sort of what got us in this.
Words of wisdom from Brian.
Yeah. So it's like, don't think that you can just assume that she's on your side and she's going to fix everything. You've got to remain vigilant too. I think that was what's going on.
Yeah, Justin had this nice line at the end.
Not as long as I've got you to protect me.
And then the scene ended. It ended in the backyard of Debbie and Vic's house, not at Babylon. So,
yay.
Yeah, show's maturing. We're having better endings from time to time. So let's wind this one up. Does it still hold up 17 years later? For me, the episode felt dated for some reason, whether it was the gay marriage part that nowadays we kind of take for granted, but we shouldn't, or maybe the way that Justin was being taunted and burned at school, because I don't think that can happen anymore these days. There's just something that made me think that we wouldn't see any of this in 2018. The Michael storyline definitely holds up, though. That jealousy, realizing that you've moved on and your friends haven't moved on, is something that definitely holds up today. So I'm going to go with a split decision on this one.
I'm a very, very firm yes on this one. First of all, it was, of the episodes we have discussed so far, it has been my personal favorite.
Really?
Yes.
Because of Emmett's scene?
partly because of that party scene, because it was fabulous fun and a fun little like revenge plot. But I feel like it really holds up because of the reconciliation that we see between Mel and Lindsay to recognize faults in relationships and to move on. I think is very pertinent. I feel like there's also something about the bigger picture I saw with everyone busting in the party, looking the way they did, was sort of facing the issue of feeling like you're too queer for mainstream. So where do they come? They come in with like the most flamboyant, stereotypical kind of gays. Like, if she's going to support gays, she has to support all of us, which I think is really impressive. Because, yeah, like we said, those were like the quote unquote A gays, the ones that could pass for mainstream society. But what about those who are on the fringe still? And I think that's a conversation we're definitely having today, especially as the queer community has grown to include people who are non-gender conforming, who are trans, who are non-binary, like having to continue to fight for those who are in our community, I think is incredibly pertinent. And also with the fact that this fight for equality is incredibly pertinent. You know, as the time of this recording, we now have a case that is going in front of the Supreme Court that could possibly lead to the challenge of marriage equality. And that's terrifying. That something that we have fought for so long to make legal is now being challenged under the guise of religious freedom again. So the fight continues. And so I think even 17 years ago, when we're having these protests outside this school, you think things have gotten better. But again, we have to remain vigilant. So I think it's also important that we continue to support our candidates who are fighting for equality as well. And I love that they make that such a strong point in this episode. So again, I was a huge fan of this episode, and I think it holds up incredibly well.
Okay, so Matt was a firm yes on this one. I was split decision on this one. Thanks for joining us as we talked about episode 17, Solution, how the lesbian formerly known as Melanie got her name back.
Join us next week for number 18, entitled Surprise Kill.
Until then, I'm Patrick Randall.
And I'm Matt Dominguez.
Thanks for listening. Leave a like, share with a friend, and subscribe so you don't miss our next episode. Still, Queer as Folk was written and performed by Patrick Randall and Matt Dominguez. Made with love in Chicago.
Hey, Todd, how's it going?
Fine.